Bong, bong, bong. It's time for the Security Weekly News, episode 153. Welcome to the week of 26 September 2021. Side-Eye Toddler, Zix, Clubhouse, vCenter Redux, Auntie M from Microsoft, SafePal, Virgil Griffith, and the FBI. All this and Jason Wood on the Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
The complexity of cloud infrastructure means every organization's security challenges are unique. Whether your challenge is threat hunting, policy management, cloud workload protection, or all of the above, Uptix helps you quickly identify and eliminate observability gaps in your security programs. Uptix, analytics for the modern attack surface, observability for the modern defender. That's Uptix, UPTYCS. Check them out at securityweekly.com/Uptix for a free trial.
Welcome to the Security Weekly News. I wanted to start off with a dedication to Clément Dupuis. Clément ran the CCC, or the CCCure site, for as long as I can remember. I guess always as long as it was there, and was probably the best CISSP instructor in the whole world. His daughter informed me yesterday that he had had a terrible stroke and was not expected to recover. So the world really lost a great instructor and an all-around great person, and we won't see his like again. Cheers, Clément. Zix is an email solution that includes encryption, filtering, and all the usual suspects. According to this report from ArmorBlox, that is that it's being spoofed, or it's being used as a partial spoof to create a credential spear phishing attack that arrives from a domain called thefullgospelbaptist.com, which apparently it was a legitimate domain that represented some kind of religious organization. Now, I, for one, know that when I get any email from any religion, it usually just says, die, heathen bastard. But that's, you know, that's just sort of that expectation when you're a worshiper of Cthulhu. But anyway, the fake encrypted email has targeted about 75,000 Office 365, Google, Gmail, Workspace, Exchange, Cisco, you name it, users. And it does appear to be a spear phishing attack, and it is custom targeted to individuals in a whole bunch of different industries. It was a small number of people that were targeted, though, and he said each one of the emails was customized to try to keep people from spreading the news that this was some kind of phishing attack. The subject header is a secure Zix. It says secure Zix message, which I've never used Zix, but I have seen messages from this. And basically that product, like most of the other ones, puts that in the subject field so that you theoretically presume it's a safe message, as I get those all the time. And so you basically say, like, I got one the other day that said, you know, secure message, you have received a fax from Gene White. And I was like thinking, well, if I get any faxes from my father, well, they usually come in on the fax machine that's attached to the Ouija board. So I'm usually pretty suspicious. But these particular ones have a message button that asks you to read the encrypted email. So, you know, click here to read this encrypted message. Nothing really new there. I mean, it was stuff that we've seen a lot. But then apparently this gets past a lot of detection stuff because A, it comes from a legal domain or a legit domain. B, it doesn't have any hostile content in the actual email itself. And, you know, everything else is off-site. And C, it seemed really similar to real Zix messaging. So I guess all those things have let it slip through a lot of these email solutions. The guys are getting really tricksy with this. Apparently now that domain is mostly blocked in enterprise solutions, but if you don't have some sort of filter and you don't have some serious anti-phishing training going on, I think you're going to see a lot more of these types of things because we're filtering so much stuff now. I was talking to somebody just the other day about how these messages we get from a place where I have an email that says in the subject field, you know, approved message or offsite message that's been reviewed or whatever. You know, it's pretty easy to put that in the subject field. So if the domain is something that is somewhat legitimate that's being spoofed, well, you know, people may well click on those emails. So again, have to up that game a little bit. Since we're doing stories I don't usually do, you know, like phishing and things like that, how about one about breaches? you know, I mean, they're so common. It's like, you know, every day there's a different breach or something. And after a while, you're just kind of like, well, you know, it's like shootings. It's like they happen constantly. So, okay. But this one's kind of interesting to me from sort of a different angle. So the snazzy headline that was on here was 3.8 billion with a B phone numbers were leaked from Clubhouse. Okay. I mean, that's a big number. So 3.8 billion with a B is a lot. But, you know, it's just another breach, you know, on and on and on. But I guess, you know, in fact, I guess it was kind of like they stole the old white pages from the hotel in Manhattan. You know, like, woo, look what I got. Like, okay, woo, we got public phone numbers. Yay. But, and as you might guess, they had a lot of trouble selling this trove of wealth. In fact, they couldn't find anybody to buy it on the dark web, which is saying something. But so let's use a little bit of database theory. So in relational database, if you take a table that has your address and you join two other tables to that table with the address key, and voila, you've got a join. And, you know, go relational database. So what if you put some hacking mentality behind it and, well, you actually had 533 million with an M Facebook profiles that were leaked back in April that just happened to contain, wait for it, phone numbers. And suddenly, well, you have username and password from Facebook and a phone number from Clubhouse, and you've got a trifecta of OSINT. With those three things, you can probably get around multi-factor if they're using a phone number to validate their multi-factor. I mean, you know, if you watch that, there was a segment, it was a while ago on Security Weekly, but it was like, you know, the last month or so, about SIM swapping. You know, you realize you can use that SIM swapping social engineering attack or bribery attack, depending on where you're located and how good you are at social engineering. And you can use that for spear phishing, heavy breathing calls. I guess you could use that number for that, which I don't get the heavy breathing call. That used to be a thing, right? It would be like, oh, we got a heavy breather. I used to see police reports like that. And it's like, a what? Is it people just call people up and go, I mean, like, do you get some kind of weird satisfaction from that? I don't understand that sort of stuff. But, you know, I don't understand, like, subway platform masturbators and people like that either. But, hey, we've all seen those, right? And honestly, the subway platform masturbator guy is a whole lot better than the subway platform person taking a dump, which was a lot more offensive somehow. But anyway, back to the point. So the whole archive now of the 3.8 billion and the 533 million has been joined on that telephone field, I presume, and listed on the dark web for sale for $100,000. Apparently, they haven't had any takers, so they're already starting to subset it and say we can give you a specialized list or whatever out of this other set. So, of course, maybe all that data is already out there. Maybe so much stuff's been stolen that it just doesn't really matter anymore. I don't know. But apparently, you know, somebody thinks it's interesting. I was interested in this in particularly because of the join idea and, you know, that join problem, which is also used in sort of pseudo-legitimate stuff for tracking fingerprinting. Like we had an Apple story last week about how you sell it, do not track me. And then now the companies just use fingerprinting information to identify that phone by how much memory it's got and all these other factors. And they create a fingerprint and then they join that to data from other places in order to see what you're up to. And so with all the data that's out there, it's starting to really be a real possibility where you can join two or more breaches together. And then all of a sudden you have pants for a four-legged friend. Or something like that. But anyway, I do think we're going to have to come up with something that will stop credential stuffing and probably pretty fast. Maybe remind all your peeps that they should not be using the same passwords and usernames everywhere. And that whole phone thing is a bit scary. So it might be time for you to put out a white paper or something explaining some of that to all your, you know, employees or whomever you are involved with as a cybersecurity professional to let them know about SIM swapping and some of these other things. Okay, I already reported this once, but I'm going to reiterate it. CISA warned that CVE-22005, which is the file upload vulnerability in vCenter server, is going to be widely exploited, and that users should expect widespread exploitation of this because the exploit code has been made public. So there was a 24th of September confirmation that this exploit is being actively exploited. I think I said exploit like 19 times in that last little section. CISA also reported that they are seeing mass scanning four vulnerable vCenter servers by threat actors. They went on to say that you should patch as quickly as possible. All of that is stuff we know, but I just want to reiterate it because obviously people are not patching this. And as I've said before, patching vCenter, patching VMware can be kind of complicated. And it may mean taking a lot of stuff offline. I don't know what the patch involved, but you know it's still there. This is the second major vulnerability in several months for vCenter and really, really needs to be patched apparently, since if someone can access the vCenter server on the network, well, they can upload a file via port 443. And if they can do that, they can execute arbitrary code, which would allow them to take over control of the server. Since vCenter is essentially only accessed through the network, well, if you're using it, someone can likely access it via the network. And if someone can access it, well, okay, now we're back there. And of course, you trust everyone on all your servers, right? I mean, yeah, stop hitting yourself. Sure. Microsoft added an Exchange server feature that automatically applies interim mitigations for high-risk security flaws. So this is an interesting approach. On the heels of several zero days that are still haunting email admins, like proxy logon, this new component is called the Microsoft Exchange Emergency Mitigation Server, which actually spells memes, so they probably don't want to use that. So they called it M or Anti-M. Were you were there and you were there and you and then you took out our Exchange server. Yeah, with those flying monkeys. Microsoft released a tool called Exchange On-Premises Mitigation Tool. Boy, they come up with some tough to say things. That one's EOPMT. Yeah, even backwards you can't say it. Tempoi. Yeah, okay, so we'll just call it Exchange On-Premises Mitigation Tool in March, which assisted with proxy logon vulnerabilities and detecting them and so forth. But this new component will run as a service, and it will be automatically installed if you deployed the CU in September or later on Exchange 2016 and 2019. Basically, the tool looks for vulnerable servers, and it applies some sort of interim mitigation that Microsoft has determined will fix it until a security update can be released. There's three types of mitigation they listed here that it could use. One was a rule that blocks specific patterns of malicious HTTP requests. I guess it depends on what's happening. One was disabling of the service, and one was disabling a vulnerable app pool. Now, all three of those things sound like, except the first one, the other two sound like things that could have a pretty dramatic effect if it suddenly disables a particular service that you use. So you can disable this feature if you want to, or you're worried about the implication of these kind of sudden changes, which will, of course, put Microsoft off the hook, and they can say, well, hey, we gave you a mitigation tool. You still got hacked. That's not our fault. And then you can also manipulate these mitigations, apparently. So now you got another thing to review in your patch committee, which is, does the mitigation work? What should we do with the mitigation and so on before we get to the patch review? But manipulating the mitigations, band name called it. But you can control it using PowerShell and other scripts. Microsoft said they would only mitigate the most severe security issues. So, you know, like 0 days. SafePal Wallet is basically an app that is used for managing crypto. But the SafePal Wallet Mozilla Firefox add-on is something else entirely. Basically, it's an app that empties out your wallet and leaves you in a virtual alley bleeding without your ID. The add-on was in the Firefox store for 7 months. And but basically SafePal, the legit SafePal is a wallet app that can hold more than 10,000 types of assets, including all your popular cryptocurrency stuff. So, you know, it's a wallet. Mozilla took the add-on out of the store, but the phishing site that was associated with this app by the developers of the app is still up and running. There were warnings in the review of the app on their app store that said, do not use, on the Mozilla store, that said, do not use, do not download, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, obviously people don't always read reviews or take one-star reviews seriously. The phishing site's up, and the phishing site asks you to put in a 12-word backup phrase, which is a standard way that these wallets get created for you. And if you put this 12-word backup phrase, according to the website, it will pair your SafePal wallet with the site. Yeah, you should do that. Right. But if you do enter the phrase, it doesn't seem to do anything, but it does forward your passphrase to the attacker, probably with other information, and you can guess what happens then. So understand SafePal itself is a legitimate product that is for phones. So it's a mobile app. and they don't make browser extensions. So basically, somebody spoofed the name of a known app, put that in the Mozilla store, which says it has all these layers of review, but apparently this slipped on through. So, but you know, anyway, be careful with that crypto, because you're basically walking on the subway platform with a big bag that says swag on it, or one of those big dollar signs or pound signs or euro signs or whatever, whatever's appropriate in your, you know, your locale. And you're, you know, you're on the subway station platform at about 3 a.m. and the station's in the South Bronx and it's about 1978. So, you know, be careful out there. Virgil Griffith pled guilty. It's not Leroy Jenkins, but it kind of you know, has that flow. Virgil Griffith, you know, kind of thing. Pled guilty to assisting the Democrat. I love the name of the country, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Sounds like an idyllic place to go and immigrate to, right? I mean, I want to live in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. That's what we call North Korea. Yeah, so maybe not so democratic, not really a republic. But I don't know. Anyway, Griffith is a crypto expert who worked as a special projects dev and researcher at Ethereum. Now, Virgil was arrested in November of 2019 by the FBI, and he had traveled to North Korea to present on how to use crypto and blockchain to launder money and evade sanctions because, you know, it's North Korea and they need those things. Now, that's a talk you probably won't want to attend in person at DEF CON anyway, but, you know, and you probably don't want to attend it in Pyongyang unless you're living in Pyongyang already. But he provided information on how North Korea could use crypto to gain independence from the global banking system. Now, Griffith had already been denied permission to go to North Korea by the State Department because you have to get special permission and all this stuff just to travel there. But he got a travel visa on separate paper. And what that means is they just take a little sticker and they staple it into your passport instead of actually stamping your passport, because then you can tear it out when you leave the country and get rid of it. They do that quite a few. They do it in Hong Kong, they do it in Israel, and a lot of times countries where people, you know, you may go to another country where you don't want there to be evidence that you've been to, say, Israel, you know, and when somebody examines your passport the way they examined mine in Moscow. I mean, they spent so much time on mine when I was trying to leave Moscow, I got worried they were stalling while the local gendarmes showed up. And then they asked me if I used to date someone named Jill or I knew someone named Tyler. And I mean, they looked at my man, I'm not even kidding. They looked at my passport with three different weird colored lights, and several different people came in to examine it. And they examined everything. They were undoing the stitching. They were doing all this stuff. And I mean, I've seen diamonds being examined less thoroughly than this. But anyway, Griffith is a U.S. citizen who resides in Singapore, and he could be sentenced to up to 20 years in federal prison in January of next year, and he pled guilty. So, you know, I don't know what they'll sentence him. He probably made some other. He was given a lot of information to the FBI, apparently. Along with that, the FBI can get data about you from Facebook and other social media sites, if you didn't know that already. But they can apparently hang on to it for years and never let you know that they're collecting it. They don't have to notify you this is going on. They can just call Facebook and say, hey, Mark, you know, I need some info on this guy. So this particular story is about an investigation of a person who is a computer security consultant in Puerto Rico and said Facebook notified him in March of this year that they had turned over all his data in 2019 to the FBI, and they were just now notifying him that that had happened. Facebook said it received 61,262 requests from the federal government to look at user data in the United States just in the last 6 months of 2020. Microsoft indicated they had 2,400 to 3,500 secrecy orders, which is what these things are called, each year since 2016. And that's about 7 to 10 a day. So there's obviously a lot of focus on this. Google said in the first half of 2020, they received 39,536 requests for 84,662 accounts. Apple indicated 11,363 requests. You get all that down? A lot of this apparently stems from 9/11 Patriot Act type stuff, but there has been a lot of alleged abuse of this by the Justice Department as well. For instance, former President Donald Trump's administration was requesting email data on journalists and such, not people who had committed crimes, just people they didn't like. Since there's several pending lawsuits and such regarding the Fourth Amendment, which may prohibit collecting this information in secret or not, the Justice Department says they're reviewing a policy on this matter of non-disclosure orders. I mean, you don't want to have to tell bad people that they're being watched, but they are just sometimes snooping on people, and it could be a problem, like Pegasus type stuff. But anyway, no one's a bad guy until they become a bad guy. Right now, he's the last of the great van painters. You want a herd of rushing stallions on the side of your van, a solar system, or that naked guy from Rush? You guys seen those vans, right? I mean, like all three of those were people I knew that had those vans. But there's no other place to turn to take your 1978 Dodge van from zero to hero with an airbrush. It's Jason Wood.
I did not expect that one.
Yeah, it was a little, the one I wrote previously, I was like, I can't say this on a public forum.
I'm glad we went to the airbrushing.
Yeah, I had to go to this one. Was not as good as the first one. I laughed a lot, but then I was like, yeah, I'm not saying this.
Oh, hey everybody, it's good to be back with you. So I was hunting around, what am I going to talk about? And I found this story on the Register that just brought back some really bad memories for me. And I thought I'd highlight it here. It's not entirely, it overlaps with cybersecurity, if you will. And it's really, you know, a critical component of any organization. And honestly, it, you know, the event itself, I'm complaining about my bad memories. This is making a lot worse memories right now. GiantPay is a UK-based payroll processing firm. So their core business is making sure people get their paychecks. Everybody really wants to have those things show up when they're expecting them to. But in this case, they didn't, because apparently they were evicted of, and I quote, a sophisticated cyber attack. End quote. The incident itself took place on September 22nd, and the company didn't say anything. Nothing came out about it until Friday evening on the 24th. The end of the day that everybody's expecting their paychecks here. And at this point, they announced, oh my goodness, basically, we've temporarily suspended all services, everything we do, and taken down all systems, except evidently their web server, because they were able to hang a poster out on the internet. And according to an article on Computer Weekly, which I also have the link in the show notes, the company did this out of, I quote, a measure of caution, end quote. Now, that's a heck of a measure of caution. Unsurprisingly, the 8,000 contractors in the UK who expected to get paid so that they could like eat and put fuel in their cars and pay their rent and stuff like that, they're not enthused about it. They had no communication of it until they either saw it in the news or they saw it on the website. They just basically didn't get paid last week, or at least the company said that they managed to make some payments to these 8,000 people, but there are discrepancies about, you know, was it accurate, and it probably almost certainly wasn't. Pretty bad scene here. I was looking around for details, like, what is the sophisticated attack? You know, what happened? And at this point, the information is non-existent. Was it a ransomware attack? Was it something else? No idea. GiantPay hasn't said. And in some ways, I didn't like their statement because they really used terms that seemed to downplay what went on and what was happening. You know, they used things like, it was a suspicious activity. There's a technical issue that caused this to happen. And at the same time, they're kind of hyping up like, you know, this is really tough, guys. This was a sophisticated attack. Honestly, I have my own thoughts on what the sophisticated attack may have looked like, but there's nothing out there publicly. This is just me speculating. So I'm just going to leave it at that. What I did want to look at was really the part that this highlighted clearly and should have been prepared for, which is their response to the incident. They see something on Wednesday, they freak out, they shut everything down. This includes the core function of their business. I mean, really, it is the heart of what they do and the heart of what they get paid for. Nearly all of us have probably brushed up against applications or changes that we wanted to make in environments that had the possible slight potential to touch something that was a core business function, and how difficult it was just to make that change, much less take it all down, everything down. So something either really put the fear into them, or the attackers actually took the systems down and they're just trying to get things back up. And they didn't actually take it down themselves out of an abundance of caution or anything else. At this point, it's obviously ready. GiantPay was not ready for this type of incident. I suspect they have documents that say business continuity plan, disaster recovery plan, and incident response plan. But right now, their only mechanism of communicating is to hang a poster up on the internet that gives statements, because they lost all access to their phones and their email systems. And even if they have email systems, maybe they don't have email addresses to communicate with. There was no preparation here for this. Either the plans didn't consider this possibility, or how they thought they would address it was just insufficient. And, you know, honestly, BCP, DR plans, IR plans, these are things that tend to be written once and updated infrequently, unless the organization commits serious resources to maintaining this. Places I've seen that have done this, they have, you know, a team that is responsible for this component of recovering and protecting the organization. Other organizations, they don't do that. They set up a backup system. They scrape together some docs and they say, good, we're golden, and they move on. You know, managing these processes, it takes a lot of commitment. A lot of time, people, well, maybe not a lot of people, certainly in an incident requires them, but a lot of preparation and planning for it. At this point, GiantPay is just scrambling. And unfortunately, I've seen this happen. I've seen it in places I've worked. We've seen it in other stories. And this is something we need to be prepared for. All organizations need to be prepared for the possibility that they're going to lose. The adversary is going to do something damaging enough that's going to take out the entire organization. What are you going to do? And nobody wants to consider that. That's a really unpleasant scenario, and people are going to be like, well, how realistic is that? How much do we really need to prepare for that? Certainly I would have gotten that heat. I can think of places I got that heat in past life. But they have to be faced because things like this happen. The alternative is obviously to deal with a much worse situation, and one that no organization does well when they're under extreme pressure. So we go back to these terrible memories being created. What are those? Well, I mean, people in the UK, they expected to get paid and they didn't, or they didn't get everything they expected. And that has an immediate impact, right? Very painful to their customers. One person was quoted saying they found out about the issue apparently when they didn't get paid. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They finally went and looked sometime on Friday night and saw the statement up on the website and said, hey, we've got a problem. Another commented that most firms practice for things like events like this. And that was a quote. I'm afraid this person would be very disappointed to see the reality of what most firms' preparations are. I've seen it done pretty well. We've seen examples of it done pretty well. September 11th, for example, it was amazing to see how fast some of these firms came back up, but there were others that didn't, and it took a long time. I'm afraid too many rely on tribal knowledge and their ability to improvise their way out of an incident. And, you know, it just isn't sufficient when it happens. I can recall, you know, trying to get backup systems upgraded and stuff like that. They were woefully inadequate. And I had two times where, you know, you start to hit the panic button. One time I'm riding into work and a building along the way is fully engulfed in flames. And you're just like, oh, dear heavens, let that not happen to us. Another time a wildfire, you know, Los Angeles area was where I was at. And you know, it happens. Wildfires causing evacuation of the areas where our office was. Me and my coworker are ripping servers out of the rack and putting them in his car so he could drive them home overnight so that we could put him into a building somewhere if we needed to the next day. That is not a situation you want to be in. No organization is prepared at that, is going to be able to do well in an incident like this with that level of preparation. So here's our homework. If we are involved with or have influence with individuals who manage the BCP, DR, and IR plans, it is time to take a look at this, right? Use this as some motivation and some justification for why we're doing this and say, yes, it can happen. Here's an example of it. And it happened last week to this organization. What can we do about this? This is a core function of IT, and it's certainly part of our world in security, availability, right? Be able to get things back up and not lose access to everything. No matter how skilled everybody in an organization may be, whether in technology or in other departments, we need to have these plans because being under fire is a terrible time to try and create them from scratch. I'm sure the people waiting on their paychecks would have preferred that measure of caution to be used back before this happened rather than take everything down as a measure of caution now. And honestly, as far as impacts go, on top of all of the business impacts and the customer you know, being really pissed off and stuff like that. Anytime an organization does payroll for thousands of people and they don't make paychecks, be prepared for your local your politicians and your government to come calling and to be hostile. I suspect that will be act two in this particular real life drama / tragedy. So go take a look at that. This is, you know, it happens.
Have you ever noticed how like none of the attacks ever say it was a mediocre effort by some really lazy? It's always a sophisticated attack. It's every school I visited with my daughter, they were like, we're excellent. All our programs are excellent. I was like, then I always wish I just get that one that goes, yeah, you know, we're just kind of like middle of the road, you know, but you never see that. I know.
We get it done, but you know, if something really happens,
it's just kind of a holding pattern for 4 years.
Guess is as good as mine is how this is going to play out.
It's so much fun.
Yeah. Probably never going to hear that statement.
No, I don't think it's always going to be a sophisticated attack. I've never seen one yet. All right.
And some of these sophisticated attacks, when you look at them, you're like, that wasn't that.
Oh, they logged in using the password BigDaddy69 that was being used for root. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Anyhow.
All right. Thanks, Jason. In the, I'll take first world problems for 1,000, Alex. Okay. This is like, this story just blew me away. Side eye toddler. Okay. So if you don't know that, that is the face that's launched 1,000 snarky memes. It's this little kid sitting in a car seat, kind of giving you the look. I mean, everybody's seen this meme, right? This was the latest NFT, or non-fungible token, a cool word, non-fungible token, band name called it, was sold. The price for this meme was $74,000, but it was issued in cryptocurrency, which could be $1.99 or $1 million and a couple of Subway tokens. It depends on which hour of which day. But anyway, Chloe Klim, who is the side-eye toddler herself or hisself, I don't know if it's a, I don't know, male, female, or doesn't identify, it doesn't matter. The person, they, Chloe Klim, the disdainful child giving the side-eye reaction to end all side-eye, sold the NFT to 3F Music in Bahrain, or I know Dubai, sorry, in 3F Music in Dubai on Friday. The company, it says right there, the company based in Dubai paid 25 Ethereum or Ethers for the non-fungible token. It's part of a selling trend for these things, which have generated sales of weird memes like overly attached girlfriend sold for $411,000. Girl with burning house or disaster girl for $500,000. And Doge, which I don't even know what that one is, that one sold for $4 million. And 3F, this whatever this music company in Dubai is representing, seems to be the buyer of several of these. So if you don't understand NFTs, well, it's kind of like owning a painting. I had to explain this to somebody the other day. It's kind of like owning a painting. I mean, you know, anybody can go to the Louvre and see the Mona Lisa, or you can go and see the Persistence of Memory or something like that. But only one person gets to actually own the painting. Even if you let other people see it, you can still say, I own it. And you can let people take pictures of it, maybe. But I own it. So if you're into such things, we'll get your crypto wallet out and start bidding. Thanks, Jason, and thanks for joining us today on Security Weekly News. Aaron will be doing the show on Friday from London, because I'm flying somewhere. So I will see you next week. Please get your shots, really.